Blog Talk Radio.
If you like painting and saving, ask Sherwin-Williams and save 40% on paints and stains during our 4-day super sale, July 18th through the 21st. With 40% off our paints and stains and 30% off painting supplies, you can give your whole home a color makeover. But hurry, these savings are so super, they won't be around for long. Find your nearest store at sherwinwilliams.com/sale. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. I am Lisa Zimmer, and I am your host of Unlimited Realities. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I am so very happy to give today's guest the spotlight for his show, Carmageddon. Jeff Brown is our guest today. And he has been working on a film for years, Carmageddon, which is a documentary highlighting Kirtan Chanter, Bhagavan Das, who is showing both his wisdom, his ego, some shadow, some light, and really tackling a subject here that has been kind of shrouded in secrecy within the spiritual community, something that definitely needs to be addressed. I suggest everyone who walks the path on spiritual awareness and within the community watch this film just to get a glimpse of the other side of the coin. And without further ado, let me bring Jeff Brown to your audience listening ears. Jeff Brown, welcome, welcome to Unlimited Realities. Thank you for making the film Carmageddon. Such a brilliant, wonderful film.
Thank you, Lisa. Always a pleasure to be with you, and I'm excited to do my first interview about the film with you. It feels really right.
Well, it's wonderful that I'm here to be your interviewer, because I think we've got so much to discuss and so much to get into. And I watched this film. I watched it 3 times, and each time I watched it, I got something else out of it. So it's something that has really plagued me. The question: why do people highlight and idolize often spiritual teachers? And you came into this soul calling of doing this documentary with your friend Paul Hemrand, and it was actually started with the belief that you wanted to bring Bhagavan Das wisdom to the masses, which he has tremendous spiritual insights. However, a little bit of a bait and switch that happened here while you were doing the documentary. Let's talk about how this all started and what was the impetus to your call in doing this documentary.
Well, I had first encountered him. He's real powerful for me. You know, his chant was powerful for me. I didn't know him as a spiritual teacher. I knew him originally as a chanter, and he's one of the most powerful chanters in the world. Kirtan chanters. And I, in 1998, there was a love connection I wrote about in Soul Shaping, and we'd gone to Harbin Hot Springs, and I'd been really blocked in my sexuality in that connection. It was so frighteningly powerful for me. I wasn't ready to ride the heart genital highway yet. You know, I like things partitioned off. And so we were struggling because I was blocked, and we went to Harbin Hot Springs, and Bhagavan Das was chanting that night, and this place is quite wild, and I'd never seen anything like it. And that chant opened me so much that I kind of crossed over that night, and the relationship went to the next level. So I already had really strong positive associations with him and his music. And, you know, his chant is like it reverberates internally. It's like an excavation tool almost, at least for me. And then he came to Toronto many years later, and we just became friends. Like he's a Vedic astrologer, so he did a reading for me and some other friends I gifted them to. And then the next year he was coming to Toronto, and we had a few conversations in between, and you know, he just felt very familiar to me, you know, like zany familiar, brilliant familiar. I was just real comfortable, you know. He's, in a way, he's quite embodied. I mean, it's complicated, but I like that energy about him. And so then he was coming to Toronto, and my friend Ronnie Lynn Postel across the street, she said, why don't you just shoot a doc? And it was like, yeah, you know, not that we know anything about making a film. I still don't know what this film was shot on. But so I called my best friend, and the poor man, I pushed him into it, and we thought we were only going to spend $1,500 each. No, I think it was $1,000, and he said he'd go to $1,500. That was his limit. And we thought it would be a quick and easy, you know, thing. And we knew it was going to have a shadow component to it because we were going to call it Shadow and Light. I mean, you spend 5 minutes with Bhagavad Dasa, you know you've got to incorporate the shadow. And so we started to film me and him. So there was a journey happening. We were filming this interaction and these dialogues and these journeys. But I think that I expected more of the film to be focused on straightforward teachings. He taught me in his own way, but not in the way that I expected. And then 7 years later, you know, our first festival was Hoboken, and it was exactly 7 years to the evening of when we first started shooting the film. So it's interesting.
Wow. That is very interesting. How timely. Did you feel challenged at all while you were uncovering the shadows, while you saw the shadows within Bhagavan Das? With your own faith?
With my own? And you know that's so much of what the film's about. And yeah, it was really on a lot of levels a very complicated experience for me. And because I was really, you know, I was in the transference. I mean, and I talked to Ram Dass about that in the film. You know, we all do this, right? I was really in the projecting the God thing onto the other. It's like we can't look in the mirror and see God. We're just still too trapped in the shame structures in this culture,
right?
You know, but we're okay to look for it outside of ourselves, and that's of course when the trouble begins. Because why should that which is outside of ourselves be any less or more imperfect than what lives within inside of us? You know,
amen.
And because his music was powerful. And because in his healthiest places, this dude is a super, super wise guy. I mean, he has had a body of experience and wisdom and sharpness and no bullshitness that is like almost unrivaled on this planet. I've never encountered that combination. You know, the shadow's a whole other story, but I was really, really into that. And I love dialoguing with somebody on that level of consciousness.
And he was, he did show his raw reality, his truth. He was very honest. He was very, he came from a place throughout your documentary that, you know, there was no apologies. There was no apologies to his shadows. There was no apologies for his womanizing. He was who he was. And on that level, if you can take it as he is, without projecting the God persona onto him and take the wisdom and accept that, there's a whole lot of growth that you can get from this.
Go ahead. Well, absolutely complicated. I mean, absolutely. I mean, there's something about him that's quite free. You know, like he'll just go outside and urinate on the front lawn. I mean, you know, he really is in many ways really actively in the animal body. You know, we got into that, some of that in the film, and he talked about that in the film. And there's something for most of us who are trapped in this habituated, adapted consciousness that's very compelling and freeing about having somebody with that level of wildness in your environment. You know, when you have a good time with Bhagavan Das, you never had a better time in your life, right? he's a master at playfulness, and he's a master at loosening up and having fun, and he really does want to go for the joy when he can pull himself up and out of his stuff, and that was one of the most beautiful things about him. There's nothing rigid about him, you know, in that way.
Right.
And yeah, I was really, and that comes through his kirtan, that comes through his chanting, you know. If you just sit in that room with him and he's in the zone and you really get lost in it, I mean, you have to have resonance with him, obviously I did, but, you know, I felt as though it was like there was a chisel inside of my consciousness that was clearing away the debris so I could get to a more clarified experience of the moment. I mean, that's the upside of the free side of Bhagavan Das, right?
Wonderful, wonderful. Now, he was born on Laguna Beach, California, and he was Kermit Michael Riggs, and then went to India in 1963 at 18 years old. He studied...
Was it 63 that he went?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Even before the real revolution. Wow.
Before, yeah. So he was, you know, no wonder that he had such an incredible following, because he, you know, in many ways for our Western culture, he was very, you know, indicative of what, evolved beyond Christianity or Judaism or something that was more
substantiated
in our culture.
I mean, he was. I mean, let's just before we. I know we're going to get more into the shadow piece, but on the in the light sense, what he did at that stage when nobody was going to India much, early '60s, mid '60s, that time frame, to go there at that age, like 19. And he really was a quester, and to go and have these profound, deep work-through experiences with all kinds of different forms of spirituality, meditation, meditating deeply in the TM movement, right? You know,
right.
Hanging out with the Sikhs in their basements, just meditating and simplifying, walking around with no place to live, connecting to humanity in the way that they do there, getting supported by the community. People would follow him around everywhere. I mean, he's striking, 6 foot five, you know, big Californian. Imagine him in India in the 60s. I mean, you know, beautiful singing voice, really, really at that time, you know, deeply in the heart of presence. And what a courageous thing. And look at the impact it had. Let's give the man some credit. Ram Dass, Richard Alpert shows up, meets him, hears about him. Bhagavan Das brings him to Neem Karoli Baba. Ram Dass has this great awakening. He comes back and writes what was the second best-selling book in American history at one point, Be Here Now, which champions a beautiful way of being for Western culture. And really, it started with Bhagavan Das saying to Ram Dass, get out of your head and be here now. You know, that's where the title came from. So that's the first leg of his journey, and wow, how beautifully impactful was that?
It's still reverberating. It's still, you know, the waves are still going through society. So we've got, you know, this is a path that so many have taken, and so many people have taken a path both in following Baba. I trip over these names because
Neem Karoli Baba
and Neem. I was going to do both of them at the same time.
Yeah.
But you know, we've got such an incredible view both of the light and the shadow in this film, and Bhagavan Das really talks about how when in going to India and in the beginning of his journey. He spent 2 years in a cave meditating. He was in isolation. He spent a month in the cremation where he used a human skull as his food bowl. I mean, the man really went down to raw and gritty. And you know, and then he comes out of it and he says he saw how the Indians really revered life, God, and love because everything that was living was adored and honored. And so that was where he got, you know, a lot of his juice from. Do you feel like in our society, where we're coming from in the Western state, that going and sitting in a cave for 2 years is really an important feat to do to reach an enlightened state of awareness? Because there's a state of awareness, there's enlightenment, there's society. And, you know, there's this piece of us that we have to evolve through our culture, through society, through the daily trekkings of the ick and the goo and all of that. Isn't it easier to sit in a cave and meditate and come to an enlightened state than to live and deal with the grocery stores and the traffic and, you know, cruel and nasty sometimes people? I mean, where do we draw the line in our real world of achieving enlightenment and not having to go sit in a cave for 2 years?
You know, I, as you know, in soul shaping, I use the term enrealment. I'm not particularly attracted to the word enlightenment. I don't think we even know what we're talking about when we use that word. You know, if it's all about the light, well, that's obviously not really fundamental to the human experience, which, you know, is really more of, ultimately, I think, an inclusive experience of everything, grocery list, unity consciousness, all of it. You know, the Eastern quest for essence, the Western quest for a healthy self-concept. You know, that trip is, to me, that meditation cave trip, although it's certainly courageous and can absolutely inform your consciousness, is for me more of a male lone wolf warrior paternalistic isolationist trip. To me, I find my more expanded experiences of consciousness in a relational field, which would probably be more the a way of being that's congruent with the divine feminine. So, you know, I think the ultimate goal, if there's an ultimate goal, is to be able to show up for every aspect of your life with presence.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes the laundry list.
Right.
And that includes the post office. And that includes lovemaking. And that includes moments of solitude in nature. And to me, enrealment is the goal, which is to, you know, most of us have split off from some aspect of the human experience with various levels of armor and degrees of addiction. And I think the work in the therapeutic revolution, and I think the Eastern consciousness, people really need to understand the benefits of the Western wisdom, the importance of a healthy ego and a healthy self-concept, you know, learning what boundaries are, you know, all of that. I think it really is important to find a way to bridge all of those things. And so it's, for me, going, if I had gone, and I did a lot of solitude in my early years, but if I had gone and done that two-year trip in a meditation cave in India, I'm sure I would have had some beautiful moments of clarity, what some people might call enlightenment. But then I know that I would come back to Western life and be right back in my relational patterns again. You know,
right.
I remember Jack Kornfield telling the story at a workshop about how he had gone and done that whole trip in the East, and he becomes like a master already, a master meditator.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came back, and he was sitting at the hair salon waiting for his wife impatiently, and he was completely agitated and, I think, enraged by having to wait so long. You know, so I think you have to work, and I think Ram Dass said this, you have to be able to, he said justify, but you have to be able to work it through on every plane of awareness to have a inclusive consciousness. And, you know, you can do that Eastern trip and actually set yourself up for a non-inclusive existence, because that becomes your groove and you miss out on the possibility or opportunity to expand in every area of your life.
Great insight. That's really great insight, because it seems to me that, and I love your term enrealment, because for me that's where I'm coming from. I feel that, you know, a state of enlightenment is an awareness state that is very hard to contain in its perfection and 100%. And I think that there are glimpses of an enlightened awareness we all have, but to incorporate it into our day-to-day practicality, it goes into an enrealment. You have to be present. You have to be within the present state of now, being conscious, being mindful, and watching your thoughts and your actions. And,
right.
You know, and that really, I really loved Ram Dass in this film. His enrealment, his awareness, his truth, his essence, and how eloquently he placed everything without a judgment, but with such clarity. I thought it was brilliant.
Well, he gets it. Well, I mean,
yeah.
I think what he says is true. For him, that having the stroke brought him fully and more fully and more deeply into the moment. I mean, you know, Ram Dass said, be here now, because he was talking to himself. You know, he wanted to be here now too, right? I mean, I wrote Soul Shaping for me. I mean, that's what we're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we hope it helps other people, but we're really reflecting back the thing we need to realize in order to have a more aligned experience in our lifetime. And so I think, you know, if I watch Ram Dass's tapes before, he was much more head-centered in the early years for me. And now when I went to see him, and I've seen him since then, and dialogue with him, because he was brought right back down into his body, into the here and now,
mm-hmm.
by the stroke, you know, experience, I feel in him that integration of what we call spirituality, like a vaster consciousness, and a more localized experience of spirituality in his emotional body. And, you know, what's very often, it's not talked about very often, but what's often missing from that particular Eastern trip, is an overemphasis on something called spirituality and the emotional body, the physical body even, our personal self-identifications. All of those things are seen somehow as substandard or distinct from our spirituality. So it's like a very convenient version of non-duality, where everything
mm-hmm.
that feels shitty is not part of the non-dual field. And I think what we're starting to realize now in this movement, and I believe towards more grounded spirituality, is that everything is part of the field. So if you can't act in an enlightened way in every area of your life, you can't call yourself enlightened, right?
Right.
I mean, if you can't show up in that way with presence in every area, you still have work to do.
And being here now. We actually are looking at things through this film and through really addressing this, that Bhagavan Das shows us our own shadows through his own. And in that teaching is a teaching. But you have Ram Das here who really shines light on the truth and walking the talk, and that he doesn't really, he honors the soul purpose of Bhagavan Das, but he really wasn't favoring his incarnation in his statement in your film. And so
so
let's look at how easy it is for those who are vulnerable, who are going through a very searching role in their life where they're looking for a deeper connection to God, they're looking for a deeper connection to divinity, and they find somebody who resonates with them as a teacher, a spiritual teacher, a spiritual leader, or a guru. And all of a sudden the resonance is so high, they feel the vibrations change within them, they feel higher, they feel a little altered even, and the truth is starting to resonate in their body form, in their soul form, in their heart.
Yep.
And then they take it to where they start idolizing the teacher and they give their power away. So why is this such a trend within the spiritual community, and why hasn't this been addressed within the spirit? It's been going on for so many years within the spiritual community, right? Where we kind of hide behind the flaws of the teachers.
So there's two questions there. So we can go deep. Yeah. So I think the first question was, why do we transfer, right?
Yes.
Why do we, right? And the other one is why do we, and the other one is why do the communities not reveal the inappropriate behavior, right?
Yes.
I think, right. So I think the first question is very, I mean, I think, you know, so much of this movie ultimately became, as you know, about the father wound. And I think that really, you know, so many seekers, and particularly women, because really 80% of the community is women, are looking for the good father. And I think it's often because they didn't have the good father, you know. And so I think that's part a big piece of the puzzle. That so when male figure sits up there and manifests benevolence and wisdom, something that they can take seriously, something they can respect, you know, women have a deep sense of what's you know, of when a dude is moving from the right place, or at least is appearing to move from the right place. They want that. They want that beauty in the connection. They want that depth in the connection. They're depth seekers, and so you know, you've got unsatisfied people looking for dad, and then you've got dad manifesting in a very seemingly perfected way, and that is, and in many cases, knowing how to work the energy so that the call deepens and intensifies, and the bridge to that person does as well. And this is the problem with all of it. If in fact that's true, if somebody has reached a stage where they are, forget enlightenment, but where they're moving from a healthier, more benevolent, deeper place, if they're moving from integrity, I think it's fantastic. I mean, we have to keep coming back to the question of, why do I want to believe that dude is actually the absolute? Or why do I want to believe that that dude is the God self? Because that's our stuff, right? Because it's not true. Because it's still here in human form. There's still work to be done. But maybe they have gotten a little bit closer. The problem is, as we all know, that some of them are working that energy for narcissistic reasons. And that is the thing that I find, I'm devastated by that. You know, because the depth of vulnerability in that place, the purity of vulnerability, you know, it's so soft and it's so subtle, and you can do so much damage when the heart is opening to the projected God self, that you have to be incredibly careful and keep doing the work to make sure that you're coming from the best intentions. Even as an author, I have to do this. I have to always check in and make sure I'm not getting overwhelmed by, you know, oh, I love your writing, Jeff, and then all of a sudden my unhealthy ego takes over. And I know when it happens because I can't write anymore, right? Because I'm not, the source spring I write from is not in that place at all. It's incongruent with that place. And I think that teachers or guides have to keep coming back to the question of where am I moving from? Where am I moving from? Because if they don't, they're going to start believing their own press clippings, and that's when the trouble begins.
Right. Now,
but in terms of the community piece, now this is, for me, a fascinating piece, because I think this is a big part. How many of these spiritual communities have allowed misbehavior to happen, and because they either have a vested interest, economic interest, in holding the structure together, not just teachers, people around the teachers too, right?
Right.
Or because they've bought into this bullshit Eastern no gossip, no judgment, as though discernment and judgment are the same thing. Of course they're not, you know.
Right.
We're not talking about arbitrary judgments. We're talking about people who get dangerous, you know.
Right.
And it's all over spiritual communities. And I think a lot of these communities have to look at this question of why have they allowed this to happen? Why have there not been movies made about this topic? You know, why are there not 150 movies out there about this stuff?
Exactly.
Why are people in those communities who end up disappointed not coming out into the world, not just in book form, but in visual form to tell their stories? It's a good question.
Yeah, it's one of those things that really makes me wonder the authenticity of so much that's out there, because it's shrouded in this secrecy that's really tainted and it's toxic.
Yeah. Yeah,
You know, how many people have been abused and are shamed into keeping silent?
Yeah, tons, hundreds of thousands,
you know?
Probably millions. I mean, I could see part of the privacy piece being that these communities really are, and in their wisdom, are set off from mainstream society. They aren't going to completely work by the same rules and structures because they don't want to be judged through a lens that doesn't understand what's happening there. So in the healthy community, it makes perfect sense to me. They keep a lot of it to themselves.
Right.
The problem is so often the communities are so deeply unhealthy. They're often led by megalomaniacs and narcissists who have just found a way to spin, and they're just energy workers. That's all they know, how to work energy. That's what they're doing. And of course, the irony of it all is that so many people in these communities actually do benefit, because despite the fact that there may be a malevolent leader in some cases, they are cracked open to a deeper consciousness that's quite a bit faster than the small, tight, linear place that they're living in this adapted culture. And I think that's why it gets complicated. Because even the people who walk away feeling burnt by it often say, I wouldn't have done it any other way.
Right, because it does trigger something in them, something
And it can open their hearts, you know. I mean, it's complicated. I know a lot of people who've been in these communities. I have never been in one of these communities. My trip with Bhagavan Das is totally different. And people have really lived in these communities, and they'll tell you that it was horribly disappointing and horribly and wonderfully liberating at the same time. You know, it's interesting.
Right, and they're all over. We have one here locally where I live in Vero Beach. We have Mahaya, who was one of Bhagavan Das's buddies, and she just passed from cancer. Yeah,
Joya just
and
died,
she,
yeah.
Let's
she's cool.
Let's talk a little bit about Bhagavan Das in regard to he openly states he worships women, idolizes Kali, and really looks at women through their, lusciousness, more of their sexuality, their blossoming, their sexuality, their birthing, all of that aspect. Did you find Bhagavan Das actually also honored wisdom, insight, spiritual depth within women as well, or did he stop simply upon the physicality of worshiping of women?
I don't know. I mean, he was with Joya for a while, and he often went to see Amma, the hugging saint.
Right.
And I know he said a number of good things about Anandamoyi Amma, who was a great saint in India, a little bit before Amma, I think, became well known. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, his lineage seems to be more affiliated with the masculine, certainly Maharaji named Karoli Baba, but I don't know what he would say about that. In terms of the question of whether or not he's honoring the feminine,
right,
that's a very, very complicated question.
Right.
I mean, certainly there's a way in which he recognizes the beauty and the fertility. There's something in the way that he honors the feminine that feels really true to me. But as you see in the film, there's a whole other side to it. So it's a good question, and one that I'm not comfortable really answering.
Okay.
You know, where is this coming from in him? And, you know,
sure.
I guess my question to you is, what was your feeling about that, watching him in action in the film?
Well, you know, he has a lot of great insights and wisdom. And so I can take the wisdom, and I have known too many so-called spiritual leaders in over the decades where I have seen their shadows. So I've never been one to give my power away to somebody. It was astonishing to me how loud his adoration of 18-year-old girls was openly in this 60-year-old plus bodied man. Because
yep.
to me, it, you know, I have four children. To me, it was borderline being a pedophile on a very strong level. And I thought, you know, there's a very thin line of comfort. I mean, I don't see how anyone can look at that who's, you know, either honored their own femininity or been a mother and can look at that and be comfortable. Because it was earth-shattering to me. It
right.
was earth-shattering to know how open he was about that weakness, that vulnerability of himself.
Well, and he may say, and I've talked to him about this, and, you know, and he says right in the movie that he's the reincarnation of Anne Frank.
Yes.
Well, he says that. He says it's
yes.
a fact, Jeff. You know, I'm a spiritual intuitive. It's a fact. You know, I was born 2 weeks after her death. Well, in fact, I don't think he was born 2 weeks after her death, but that's another story.
Right.
But I think his view would be that he came into this. I mean, he really believes in this movement from incarnation to incarnation, that he came from in the last lifetime, or he was a young girl, and that his thing for young women somehow relates to his own Anne Frank early death, the circumstances around his reality, you know, all of that, and that he's working out or living something out with the feminine in relation to his prior incarnation. Now, you may think that's absolutely crazy. Most people who watch the film think it's absolutely crazy. But the sense of incarnation, the idea that karma works this way, is very deeply felt in many areas. You know, I mean, whether he could know who he was in the last lifetime is a whole other question. But
right.
but I think he would say, and he has said to me, that his thing with the young women has something to do with his own karmic lineage. Now, there are many other views of this, right? Unresolved psychological material, you know, his relationship
right.
with his mother. I mean, there's a million different things. But that's not his answer, you know? I mean,
right.
And people will form their own opinion about that. He's been with women. He's been with all kinds of women. He's been with, I don't know that he had an intimate relationship, but he had an emotionally intimate relationship when he was, I think, a high school student before he went to India with a woman who was 60 or 70 years old, who he used to go and spend time with and study with, and I think her name was Dorothy. We filmed some of it for the film. And so he's really been all over the map, although, yeah, primarily focused in for the last number of years, I think, on mostly young women. I mean, how did you feel watching the 18-year-old girl in the movie? How did you feel when he admitted breaking his virginity at 18 with a 13-year-old, what he says, I think he said, a 13-year-old Egyptian whore?
Yeah.
How did that feel for you as a woman?
It made me sick. I mean, it made me sick. You know, I had to detach on some level the fact that Egyptian culture is completely a different knowing than what I've grown up with. However, a 13-year-old prostitute in any world, in my view, is a very, very sad script. And the fact that that story, that he felt, you know, okay in stating that story, I looked at him and I thought, was this his way of coming to terms with it for himself was this an egotistical statement, or was this a titillation? So I was trying to, you know, and honestly, I think there's a piece of all of that in that statement for him to reveal that, because it's, you know, as a mother, it's disgusting. But, you know, there's this piece here where this young girl on your film is talking about how he wanted her to travel with him and sing. And then when she kind of was brought into the realization that he wanted to have sex with her, she was repulsed because he's a 60-plus-year-old man, and she was a young, impressionable seeker at 18 or thereabout age.
Yeah, but she was solid, right? I mean, it's funny, right? Like, she's kind of like, you know, manifesting like she's all tripped out about him, but when it really comes down to it, she's really solid. Right.
She's very solid and very grounded in it. And, you know, at first I was a little, I wanted to, like, shake her through the film. And yet at the same point, as the film progresses, you find out that she got very clear very quickly.
And she's clearer than anybody. She's clearer than anybody, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Because she had the ability to see what gifts he was able to give as well in the wisdom aspect, and yet not tap into, you know, his ego or his manipulation or, you know, the sexual manipulation. You know, it was very touching. I was angered at one point in that film in regard to that, and then I caught myself and thought, well, you know, I'm angered mostly at the fact that this has been shrouded. I'm kind of touched by the fact that we can justify within the spiritual community that all actions, regardless, can be justified, and that, you know, any wrongdoings and illusion. I mean, I think that's just like you talk about. It's spiritual bypassing. It's like taking something,
right.
You know, and
absolutely.
And making,
right. It's
go
like
ahead.
something gets taken, stolen, whatever, and then it's like, okay, you know, this is what happens, you know, and then it becomes, instead of nuts and bolts, black and white, that's not okay, you know, inappropriate, bad boundaries, don't steal, whatever, the new age, the ungrounded parts of the new age movement, and I've been a part of that myself, that we go to the place of, well, you know, what am I so attached to? And she said it, the mother said it in there, what am I so attached to? You know why? You know, you begin to look at the question of what have you stolen in the past? So suddenly it moves away from the simple act of wrongdoing, and it all gets upframed and reframed, and that ends up becoming a recipe for disaster, because then people in positions of power can absolutely abuse and manipulate and keep putting it back. I had a little sex guru section in Soul Shaping where I covered so much of these examples of how this, you know, it becomes a reflection, and if you say, you just punched me in the head, guru, I'm not comfortable with that, it's not acceptable, you know, and then he reflects it back to you that you have to look back at how you've somehow punched somebody else in the head. It just goes on.
Yeah.
Like that, and
yeah.
and we lose common sense. I think when we've lost common sense, we had a section Sean Korn had we'd removed. It just didn't work in the movie, but where she had talked about common sense and about intuition, and it really, we have to start from a grounded place, you know, and then move out carefully, you know. And I think what ends up happening, and what I wrestled with in this film, you know, my journey I wrestled with, was the difference between intention and effect. And so it can be that somebody comes into your house, and because you're actually sleeping on some level, their wildness wakes you up. And that happened to the father in the movie. He cried, he opened, all the rest of it. And that's fine. There's something in it for you. But that doesn't mean that was the intention of the person in spiritual authority. And that becomes another question, which is, were they intending that for me? Because there are gurus that have done that, you know.
Right.
I mean, you know, Chogyam Trungpa was known to upset the apple cart, and people believed, and maybe this was true, that his intentionality was to set that stage up so that individual will grow in their consciousness. Now, that can be true sometimes, but it's most certainly not true most of the time.
Right. And are they actually taking into consideration the repressed trauma that the soul goes through that is afraid to discuss because there's so much shame upon the opinion of a wrongdoing, or it's looked at as a judgment when in fact it's a discernment that, hey, this guy's whacked, or this one's got some truth.
I think a lot of people don't. I think a lot of people haven't talked about their experiences with in real guru-like spiritual communities because they're actually they are absolutely. Once they come back down to earth, they can't believe they got hooked into it, and they just don't want anybody to know about it. Right.
Right. Right.
You know.
And that's sad because that's the shame. You know, that's they're carrying this shame around, and it's an unhealed wound that. We don't know what's being put in to fill that void, you know, that we don't know what's coming out.
Right.
Now, both Bhagavan Das and Ram Das studied under Keen Karoli Baba. And
Neem, he was Keen,
Neem.
But Neem Karoli, Neem Karoli Baba.
Neem
they also call him Maharaji.
Baba.
Yes.
and yet
Keen
I find
Karoli
them both.
Like.
Neem.
Is that like a Florida? Is that a Florida thing? I don't know.
It must be. It must be. It's my tongue today. It's my tongue. It's coming out. I find them very different. I find both of them having.
Do you think they're a little different from each other?
I think they're very different from each other.
Yes.
I think Bhagavan Das and Ram Das are like 180 degrees different from one another.
That's probably true.
What do you feel, you know, how do you feel their connection with Baba why did they go in different paths? Why do you feel...
Well, I mean, I think that their connection to Neem Karoli Baba in its origins and was probably coming from a very similar place. They were both seekers. You know, Ram Das was doing drugs. He got tired of drugs. He went off to India to see if he could find a connection to the God Self some other way, you know.
Right.
Bhagavan Das went to India because he was looking for something deeper than hanging out at Denny's and going to the Shambhala's temple in American culture. I mean, it's not satisfying for somebody who's looking for something on a deeper level. So I think they shared that lineage. They shared that intentionality, and they shared an openness. I think Bhagavan Das was probably more open. Ram Das acknowledges, like, reluctance. He was a cognitive psychologist, you know. And Maharaji was a pretty shocking experience. When Maharaji said to him, Neem Karoli Baba, said to him, one of the first things he said to him was, last night you sat outside under the stars and thought of your mother who died of a spleen. That transformed Ram Dass's consciousness because it turned upside down his cognitive way of understanding reality. How could you know that? Everything shifted for him. So, you know, they're both seekers. In terms of what happened after that, you know, I mean, you know, Ram Das was a grounded intellectual. He came from a wealthy Jewish family. He was used to achievement. He had a certain understanding of how to organize reality. You know, if you make an appointment with Ram Das, he's going to be there on time. I mean, he really understood the ways of the world and then moved from, and he had that deep in his bones. You know, he understood the structures, the integrity structures, all of that. And then he went out from that place and ventured courageously into very, very deep waters. And he came back with a message, and he's a perfect messenger because he's grounded, intellectual, and knows how to convey things in a way that Western culture can hear it, right?
Right.
Bhagavan Das, really, by his own description, lived wildly in his early life. Spent most of his free time outside of the house with his dog in the ocean. Truly a much more embodied being than Ram Das. Ram Das is a brilliant head tripper. And I'm not disparaging him. I'm a head tripper, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Jewish head tripper. And Bhagavan Das was a wild animal, you know. So imagine now Ram Das comes back, writes the book, gets famous for Be Here Now, but he already was well-known. He had a container egoically for that. He had been well-known from Harvard and what happened with Tim Leary and all that stuff. Bhagavan Das comes back from India, the book's already out, and he's now famous. He's never developed those structures. He's never worked through his stuff. I mean, he's gone from American life as an adolescent straight to India, deep into the Eastern Quest, the lone wolf warrior meditation cave experience. And
Right. Now
he's famous in America. And you know, if you're famous in America, there's no room to breathe. You know how it goes. I mean, the projections are everywhere. And, you know, everything just moved in really very different directions. You know, the beauty of him is his wildness. You know, that's
right. The
upside. That there's something. That's why people do love him. That's what how he's so free in the chant. You know,
yeah.
But you know, he's not going to show up for lunch on time. And you just got to understand that. He's just not. He's not going to show up for lunch on time. You know.
And
Krishna,
you know,
Das and Ram Das, they're going to show up for lunch on time, right?
Yeah, Ram Das is very grounded, and you're right when you were speaking earlier about. A shift that he went through after the stroke. There was a softness that I saw in Ram Das in your interview that I had never seen before. And it was, you know, there was such an embodiment of soul and essence that came through so differently than ever before. And such truth and just a gentleness within his truth. I really...
He's a brilliant sweetheart. But what he did in this film was revolutionary. I mean,
right.
In the community. You know, he did. He outed somebody. He said, this is not okay, and he did it on camera. And,
right.
You know, there's so much energy around not talking, about keeping it in the family. You know, he took it outside. It's now outside of the family, you know.
Right.
And that really was and is quite a revolutionary act in the community.
Oh, I thought it was such a shift that he did for all of us, because Ram Das is like the grandfather of higher consciousness for so many.
He's well loved. He sure is.
Yeah.
He holds the container. He holds a very, very.
He holds the container. And yet he really addressed how, you know, Bhagavan Das isn't congruent in all levels of his being, and that to call yourself a guru, it's one who takes the student all the way to God, and that has to be seen on all levels of consistency and and truth. And so that was a brilliant moment within that film.
He grounds the film, right, Lisa? I mean, he grounded my journey. You know, it was like I go to him, and now I've sort of got something figured out, and then I catapult to the next, the deeper question, which is not the question about Bhagavan Das necessarily, but which is the question about what am I doing here? You know,
right.
Who is this in me, and who am I in this? I mean, and ultimately, we have to all come back to that question, you know. Whoever we're projecting our Mishigas onto, or God onto, we have to come back to the question of who is this in me, and who am I in this?
Well, you know,
like, what am I doing here, you know?
That's right. And what I saw Ram Das doing for you was validating your own intuition, because you were not wanting to bash anyone. You weren't wanting to bash Bhagavan Das. You didn't want to, like, you know, throw the holy man out with the bathwater. But at the same point, Ram Das actually validated your truth. And there's so much of Ram Das's energy that really does ground, brings everything back around full circle for the subject matter of the movie. I see this in you as far as this movie is, you know, showing us our shadows. You know, there's so many mirrors in life that when we see things, it's mirroring back something to us to learn from or truth. And in this movie, it was so obvious that the underlying message is don't give your power away to a human, but you can take the message of the wisdom. And this is something that you can look at in so many different ways, but for you specifically being a spiritual teacher, I think it was something that helped in regard to uncovering that people can give you their power, you know, that you can actually have an effect upon other people. Your energy, your wisdom, Jeff Brown, even this film, your book, it has an effect on seeking souls. And so here you are viewing a man who's abused his power and his control, and you're looking at it in a way that that's not going to happen to you. You're not going to use your power in such a way that you,
right,
you know, yeah, I mean, abuse other souls.
I think so. I mean, it's so interesting because, of course, all this stuff was shot before the first edition of Soul Shaping even came out. And I was just, like, I was trying to figure out what grounded spirituality meant to me and what it wasn't and what it was. And those two guys helped me, what it was and what it wasn't. You know, parts of Bhagavan Das are parts of what grounded spirituality is for me, and parts of them aren't. And Ram Das was modeling something to me. I was really trying to understand, as I delineate my sacred purpose, whether it's as an author or ultimately as a teacher, whatever that is, you know, what's my lens? I mean, this was really primarily what this journey was about. The emotional material, the father wound material, is also quite relevant on a more personal level. But in terms of my work in the world, and I think that I was on some level deciding, it was almost like a setup for me to get a sense of who am I going to be in this if I unfold in this direction, you know? And then I wrote Soul Shaping, and now on we go. And now I'm carrying the projection of knower or wise mm-hmm. guy or reminder quite strongly now in some areas with people in social media in particular. And so I know, and I can be quite honest about this, that there was a part of me. I have a part of both of these men in me. They mm-hmm. they both reflect very real parts of me, you know. And I have a frat boy living inside of me. And I have a lover of the feminine living inside of me, and not always perfectly contained in my history, you know. Now, I don't have Bhagavan Das's history. I mean, he was nicknamed
right.
Bhagavan Dick. It's a whole other story. But in the positive place of his resonance for the feminine, I really, really got that. Like, I was hanging out with my brother, right? It was the dark side I couldn't relate to, you know, and the abuse, like all of that other stuff, the young women, not so much abuse, but all of that stuff. And Ram Das really reflects what I'm growing more into in myself, which is a more, I would say, civilized version of teacher, you know, and one who's more clearly benevolent in the way he operates. You know, Bhagavan Das is benevolent too. He sometimes works it in a way that isn't apparently benevolent. And so this was really a perfect experience for me to figure out how I'm going to do what I'm doing now. Yeah.
Right, right. And, you know, one thing that that I just really briefly want to touch on, because I didn't understand completely how it was justified, I don't understand kleptomania. However, there were pieces within the film where Bhagavan Das would like something and take it. In fact, with one of your girlfriends, he took a very sacred picture of hers, and she ended up finding it in around the home where he had put it to take it with him. Was this ever addressed? Was he ever? Did you ever call him out on that? Did he ever have a reason for it? Did he look at all things as his things? I mean, how was that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I wrote him an email in there, and I told him to apologize. And his email, rather than saying, you know, hey, you know, I shouldn't have done that, you know, or something.
Right.
It was more, you know, he went to, like, the up frame and that whole trip. And so there was never really, I've never talked to him about anything to do with kleptomania. Part of it was probably because of what I discussed at the end of the movie, which was my own discomfort with being direct in my confrontation with him, which is rare for me in my life. I got no problem with direct confrontation, but I did with him.
Right.
And the movie at the end, I think, addresses kind of what the transference was for me in that. But, you know, I think also there were bigger fish to fry for me in my dynamic
yeah.
with him than the question of whether or not he took things he shouldn't
right.
have taken.
I just find the
character. And I don't understand
trait.
Kleptomania. Sorry, and I don't understand that. I don't know that he's a kleptomaniac, but I agree with you. I just have no understanding of that.
Yeah, I don't understand it either. It was an interesting trait that he also embodied. It was a very interesting justification, I thought, as I viewed that. He did have a really wonderful statement in the movie, and it was that all of life is a metaphor. And when you can connect the mystical to the divine, you're never separate from divinity, from that divine reality. We talked about a little bit about how you see your own metaphor as he embodied both, you know, the positive and the light and the dark, and also, you know, brought back a lot of reflections of your own childhood with your father. Do you feel that there are still metaphors in making this movie that are showing themselves in your life, or that, you know, there's even still things that are presenting themselves for your own growth out of this one film that you made?
I feel like I've extracted a lot of the lesson. I'm a pretty fast learner. You know, this was soupy. Mm-hmm. Like, this was a complicated one for me, but I do also recognize that there's still something else in this that I haven't quite grokked yet, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't know what that is. I can feel it a little bit ahead on the path that there's something.
Right, so there's more,
another
more
level.
To unveil.
There's more. We'll do the sequel. It'll be a whole sequel thing.
It'll be a whole new discussion. And do you think we've hit upon a time in our evolution within the spiritual community that we can actually take the veils off and the masks in regard to our spiritual teachers, that we can see more authenticity and, you know, and really, you know, take the lesson without idolizing the teacher? Because I think there's too much idolization going on within the spiritual community. You know?
Well, I mean, I think this is going to be around for a long time. I don't think it's
right.
I think we are generally moving, crossing a bridge from survivalism as a way of being to authenticity as a way of being, and part of authenticity is transparency on every level. And so I think we're starting to come clean with ourselves, and as a result, we're starting to come clean with everything else. But I think in terms of the projection onto other as God self, I think that's going to be around for a while.
Well, and I'm sure that you've had many different opinions and comments from people in regard to the film. Have you met a lot of people who were a little miffed by it, shall we say? Yes.
I'm sure they're coming, and I think there's going to be a lot of them. But I have prepared bunkers all around the world for for the crew and me to hide in. You know, I don't know. People don't really write me too much of that stuff. They may say it behind the scenes or something like that.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are some people are put off, like even in the review, just by all the sexed up stuff and all of that. And, you know, but I don't know. I mean, I think if anyone's going to be upset, I think day-to-day people are going to kind of feel either they'll feel no resonance, or they're just going to feel gratified that, you know, that this is openly discussed. You know, I mean,
right.
that's always a good thing. Self-revealing is so important. But I think people in very hard and fast spiritual communities are going to be angry about this film. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that it is very important to address. I think you've done a wonderful job in addressing this. And also, you know, it's not like you focused upon the shadows. Bhagavan Das revealed his own shadows willingly. So it wasn't like you were kind of digging deep in there to kind of get to the worm. You just allowed, and it was. So I think that this is an important topic. It's something that anyone who's in a vulnerable state of seeking needs to be aware that the spiritual community isn't all light and pure, and that people are human. We have our issues. We're all on this path together to grow and evolve, and that there is no hierarchy. There is truth,
right,
and there is wisdom.
Right. And the way to do spiritual community, it's fine to have people that are teaching or reminding or leading or whatever, as long as they get up on there and they talk about their humanness. They don't present as realized. And they also don't work the energy in a way that's going to leave people arbitrarily suffering. There's a place for it because we are all in this together, and everybody has a little bit of wisdom to offer, and some people have a lot of wisdom to offer. And it's just really important for the teacher to keep coming back to the question of what stuff do I got to work through in myself so I can stay clean with this?
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I ask myself this question all the time because I can get lost in the projections onto me from writing now. And I do all the, and I do sometimes get lost in it, but I keep coming back to this question in the car, when I'm driving, in my world, when I'm in the shower, in my own inner narrative, which is how do I stay clean with this? Come back to purpose. Come back to what brought me to this. I didn't get into this to make money. I didn't get into this egoically. Come back to what the intention is. Go back to the source spring with the Divine Mother. Get back in the room and write. Just do that. And I think everybody who has something to offer in the field has to do that, you know.
Amen.
That's it.
That's it.
Just keep coming back and cleaning up your own. Don't ever think that because someone else thinks you're God, that you don't got shit to clean up.
Exactly.
You, and in fact, the more they think you're God, probably because your unhealthy ego's ignited, the more you've got to clean up.
Amen. Greatly stated. And I want to draw everyone to your website, which is www.carmageddonthemovie.com, where they can buy
the download the movie
movie
as of last night, actually.
That's
the movie's
amazing.
Up, the movie's
That's
up for
incredible.
Immediate download. Yeah. Just so you know.
Well, I'll be sending that out on my email list today.
God bless you.
Oh, God bless you, Jeff. Thank you so much for tackling such a shrouded, necessary topic and something that really sheds light on the shadows of the spiritual community and makes people kind of wake up and use their intuition and discernment and not look at discernment as a dirty word of judgment because it really... It's necessary. God bless you, Jeff. Thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thanks, Lisa.
God bless everyone. Have a great week. Thanks again, Jeff.
You got it. Bye.
Bye-bye.